Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson, one of your co-hosts. I'm on the air with John Gee and Kevin Christensen. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Hey, it sounds like we've got everybody online tonight. It's a first. Better cross our fingers and make sure that we don't mess that up. Hey, before we begin, I just want to say that Interpreter Radio is brought to you by two entities. And the first one is CruiseLady.com. Now, Cruise Lady is a company that sponsors this 2 hours. And if you are interested in a cruise or a tour for Latter-day Saints, Cruise Lady invites you to explore the world with a Latter-day Saint scholar. Now, the very next one to plan for is in April. That's just a few months away. So in April 2020, you can join KSL and Interpreter Radio host Martin Tanner on a Book of Mormon cruise. You'll sail through the Panama Canal. You'll see Colombia, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, and Mexico. You'll hear up-to-date Book of Mormon evidence and scholarship. Or, a little later in the year, in July of 2020, you can join Interpreter Foundation President Dan Peterson on a cruise that includes a visit to Copenhagen, Berlin, Estonia, St. Petersburg, Finland, and Sweden. Now, I've not been to any of those yet, but I've got friends that have been on that cruise, and they say St. Petersburg is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And I'm not going to talk about Ober-Ammergau, because John always winces whenever I do. But we'll save that for the next hour. But the other thing we want to let you know is that this program is put on by the Interpreter Foundation. And the Interpreter Foundation is an all-volunteer organization. I think they maybe pay one or two editorial people or administrative people, but it is incredible how it has grown from its roots in 2012. I've been following it now for 8 years, and it's a real honor to be able to participate. And they put out a weekly article online for free or more. And in fact, this week, there's tons of stuff that they've put out. There is a real important article by Don Perry talking about finding Christ in Isaiah, as well as some other things. And we're going to talk a lot more about what they've been up to during the second hour. But we're going to change our format a little bit this time. And Kevin and John and I determined that this time we'd like to start our first hour with our Come Follow Me discussion, which you'll find here on Interpreter Radio every week. And we're a few weeks out, which gives you a chance to digest some of what we're talking about. So tonight, gentlemen, we're going to be covering the Come Follow Me, that is the second week of February. In other words, I think it's February 3rd through the 9th.
It's 2 Nephi 1 through 5.
2 Nephi 1 through 5. Now, I'd like to begin by talking a little about this. This is one of the sections that we doctrinally cover maybe more than just about anything else, because it goes right back to the plan of salvation, or the plan of happiness, as some of the general authorities call it. And
the Book of Mormon calls it that.
Okay. Well, I stand corrected as always. But, you know, it reminds me of a story I've told before. I may even have told it here on Interpreter Radio, but I know I've told it in other forums. I used to commute to Las Vegas with some friends of mine. We had offices in St. George. We had offices in Las Vegas. And so that two-hour drive was a great opportunity to just discuss all kinds of things, especially about the gospel. And so one day I'm going with a friend of mine, not one that I usually rode with, but a different one. And we were talking specifically about this passage that we're covering in the Come Follow Me lessons between Lehi and his sons, Lehi and Jacob in particular. And we're driving along, and my friend is explaining something to me, and all of a sudden he says, "And here's where Lehi's wrong."
Okay.
Yeah, that was kind of both of our reactions, because I looked at him and he immediately, and he was driving, I was in the passenger seat. I think if I'd been driving, I might have swerved off the road. Not really. But I have to tell you that first and foremost, he's a very faithful individual who studies the gospel seriously. And he, let's just say, his profession is of the nature that you don't back down once you come forward with an argument.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, and yet I appreciated it not because, okay, he's trying to blaspheme or say that Lehi's wrong. He read this so seriously that it was as if he and Lehi were communicating to each other face-to-face, because there were instances where we would be talking about a doctrinal issue, and he would look at me and say, Terry, here's where you're wrong. Now, I'm Terry, not Lehi, so that's more likely to be the case than not. But even so, I have always loved those type of discussions, and I feel that we're able to do that here on Interpreter, where we can put forward ideas and communicate with each other because we respect the prophets in the Scriptures enough to take them seriously rather than just boilerplate, if you understand what I mean.
Now, well, your story reminds me of the story someone told me about going into Hugh Nibley's office, and Nibley thought he said he'd found an error in the Book of Mormon. He said, the Book of Mormon says that men are carnal, sensual, and devilish, and it should be they're carnal, sensual, devilish, and stupid. And that was the error that he found in the Book of Mormon. Well, the Book of Mormon, even the title page, admits that it could make mistakes. But to me, the original, the 1830 wording on the title page, it says, if there be fault, it be the mistake of men.
Oh, yeah.
So which you can take it in two ways. One, it could be, well, if there are faults in it, it's because there were mortals making the record. Or the other way you could take it is, if you think there's a fault in it, you're mistaken.
In fact, it's both, I'm sure. So anyway, getting to it, we've got this section that we talk about. And something that we started, John, last month while you were gone was just to ask you and Kevin or myself, if what articles or books that cover kind of this section of the Doctrine and Covenants that have inspired you or caused you to think more deeply about it as we go forward. And so John's got that look on his face, and Kevin, since he did it last month, probably has something to mind. So Kevin, we're going to lead off with you in just your suggestion of some resources that people might want that you found particularly inspiring or moving.
Well, for this section of the Book of Mormon, well, two I can remember exactly what they are. One is Brant Gardner's The Social History of the Early Nephites. It was the talk he gave at a fair conference. Just
now, you can find that online, if I understand.
Yeah, that's online. You can either listen to it or read it. But I think he just puts the Nephites in their setting in a way that I think is mind-blowing and mind-expanding. And then there's been another a couple of articles about 2 Nephi 4 and Nephi's Psalm, just going into the literary qualities of that. You know, it's beautiful to read and very intimate and you know, very telling into Nephi's character in a way that's very touching and moving and beautiful. But also, it is a psalm, and there have been a couple of people that have studied that. And there's one,
was one
that
of those
I wish I could
was
remember.
One of those Alan Goff?
For Nephi's psalm?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I don't think he usually does that kind of thing. He does allusion and type scenes more than literary patterns. But
okay.
I think Journal of the Book of Mormon Studies has them, and they're fairly easy to find. If you just look up Nephi's Psalm and in the Journal of the Book of Mormon Studies, that kind of thing will show up. But this is years ago. I was when the new era started. I just remember this, you know, over 40 years ago, just reading a new era, and a woman had written an article that was in the new era, and she talked about just a series of problems and questions that she had and that people would come up to her with about, you know, life and God and the presence of evil in the world and why is it that, you know, you could read about stuff that was happening in the Bible like Revelation, but what was happening today. And she goes through all of these kind of angsty, very modern kinds of things. And then she turns to one chapter in the Book of Mormon and she points out how they're all answered right there in 2 Nephi 2. And I was looking for it today and couldn't find it, but just that insight made a very strong impression on me that sticks with me to this day. But there's that one chapter is a masterpiece of insight.
Okay. John?
Well, I'm going to put a coda on Kevin's comment, which is that the back issues of the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies have been moved, and so they're a little bit harder to find.
Yeah, I've noticed.
They're on scholarsarchives.byu.edu, and they're not indexed well.
Yet.
Well, it all depends on how much time I've got. I started something on that. But the problem with this, you've got 2 Nephi 2 there. And there are a lot of great commentaries, and none of them are as good as the original.
That's true.
And so I
accept where Lehi's wrong.
Well, I don't know where Lehi's wrong, but...
sorry about that. Couldn't resist.
But I think you go for the original. If you're looking for probably the best commentary on 2 Nephi 5 is John Sorensen's piece in... The first issue of the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies is when Lehi arrived in land, did he find others there? And that one That one was a groundbreaking article, and it was in the first issue of the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies to come out. And that's probably the best one on that topic.
Yeah, I used to have all those in a box somewhere, and I carried them around, and then when they became available online, I thought, why am I carrying these around? And I stopped, and now they're hard to find online again. So,
well, I have the entire row on a shelf in my office. It's a phenomenal achievement when it was done. It's too bad they're discontinued that. So, but there is so much material here in these chapters in 2 Nephi that you almost wonder where to begin.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I found, something that came up, is a book called The Death of Jacob. It's narrative conventions in Genesis 47, 28 through 50 and 26. And it's written by Kerry D. Lee, published by Brill, I want to say three or four years ago. And, well, it doesn't, of course, talk about the Book of Mormon. It sets the stage and provides a context for showing that Lehi, in terms of blessing his sons, in terms of cursing his sons, in terms of exhorting them and warning them, that this is a legitimate Near Eastern pattern, if you will. And it was just fascinating to me to see that. And then, of course, we get the varied content of each chapter. So you've got 2 Nephi 2, and I agree with you, John. You can read the commentaries about it, but they don't add very much over and above the original. And then you've got 2 Nephi 3, which talks specifically about Joseph, the son of Joseph. You've got number 4, which is Nephi's psalm. And then you've got number 5, which talks about them living after the manner of happiness. And in fact, that's the title of our Come Follow Me section, is they lived after the manner of happiness. And I think it's interesting that the committees and the 12 and the first presidency, who ultimately, I don't want to say bless this, but that's a term I use from the military, approved, yes, is they chose that as the title, that the manner of happiness. This is everything in here, I think, is what we need to be happy.
And that's addressed specifically in 2 Nephi 2. And it's interesting to me that we glom onto the one idea and we take that out of context. And it's so. We quote 2 Nephi 2:25, Adam fell that men might be, and men are that they might have joy. It's interesting if you put that into a little bit wider context, the shift. Behold, all things have been done in the wisdom of him who knoweth all things. Adam fell that men might be, and men are that they might have joy. And the Messiah cometh in the fullness of time, that he may redeem the children of men from the fall. And it continues on there, but you don't have happiness without that redemption that comes through the Messiah. And sometimes we abbreviate that because we want to keep things short, and sometimes we abbreviate it because we forget that the second part is there. That mm-hmm. That if you don't have the Messiah and his redemption, then you're not going to have the joy. And so when we talk about after the manner of happiness, that's something that undergirds that throughout the Book of Mormon, and especially in these chapters.
Kevin, comment?
Oh no, I agree with that. I think it's you know, just to, that's one of the chapters that you just have to read and ponder, and it speaks to you. And those verses there, you know, to get beyond the little bits of pocket change that we know and read the context, going to open up your mind more.
I mean, I found that to be the case with Abinadi. Oftentimes when we read the Book of Mormon, and you don't want to say that, you know, something is not as helpful. But the original edition of the Book of Mormon, it had different chapters, and they were much longer. And the way that's broken up now, we in our modern world often just say, okay, I got to read my Book of Mormon, I'm going to read a chapter, and you break right in the middle of it. And when you look at, say, a sermon of King Benjamin, or Abinadi, or here, Lehi, you read a part of it, and then you break it artificially, and you don't get the full setting or context of it. So when I remember being struck as I read Abinadi all the way through in one sitting, all of a sudden I felt like I was listening to Elder Holland. And you wouldn't pause Elder Holland 2.5-5 minutes into his 20-minute talk and go get a drink of water or something, or go out, shovel the walk, come back. I mean, you might do it if it was an emergency, but you can't. You have to take the whole thing in its total in order to get the full impact. And I agree with what you're saying, John.
I wish I could remember who had this really nice insight, and it was in Interpreter a couple of years ago, about how there are certain of the chapters in the original Book of Mormon, and those chapters seem to have. Royal Skousen has argued that those chapters go back to the time
of
the plates themselves, and that they're ancient. And he was arguing in a couple of places that the original chapters have some sense about why the story that they're telling and what's being covered in the chapters. And so you can find that if you get, say, Royal Skousen's earliest text. He has those chapters in
it.
And
well, the Maxwell Institute study edition has that.
Okay.
It's not as prevalent, but they do have it in a different place as you're reading along. So you can switch. They have the modern text with the modern chapters and verses, and then they have the original.
Reader's edition does similar things, right?
Yeah.
But he also breaks out the poetry at times.
Right. And
I've got that in my hands here.
Yeah. Oh, and he that's what he did in the Maxwell Institute.
And the edition I use is the 1830, which has those.
Yes.
So that's the one I read out of. But there are ways of getting that. I do admit that the modern references are easier to locate a particular quotation or passage from than the 1830 or the older chapters are, but you can read the Book of Mormon in a variety of ways and still get profit out of it. Some people find that certain editions speak to them more than others. And so it's part of it is finding which one works for you when you're doing your study.
Well, I was trying to find that and don't have time, but it's on the interpreter website. So just go back and look for them. I mean,
as I say, I regret not being able to remember who had this really nice insight.
You're a little younger than me, John. It comes on all of us.
No, as part of it is keeping up with, if you think it's been 7.5 years almost that they've had a new article every week in Interpreter, that's 52 a year at least.
Yeah.
And so you're looking at about 400 at this point. I think anybody would have a little bit of trouble.
Yeah, well, and there's been more than one sometimes.
Yes. So,
but we were going to talk about that in the next hour.
Right.
So Kevin, you had mentioned as we were getting ready for the program that there was something about the Joseph, son of Joseph in chapter 3 that had struck you.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Some years ago in Isaiah and the Prophets, well, one thing, of course, is imagine, you know, Oliver Cowdery and Joseph doing the translation and coming across that passage and imagine the hair rising on the backs of their necks as they read it. But also it turns out that there's an article written in a book that the Religious Studies Center put out years ago called Isaiah and the Prophets, with an article by Joseph McConkie that I think is probably the best thing he ever did, is about the Messiah ben Joseph traditions, the idea that there was going to be a, along with Messiah, son of Judah, from the tribe of Judah, there was a Messiah ben Joseph who would come in the last days as a forerunner. And there were a couple of things about him, one of which is that he would be killed. That made it kind of interesting. And John Tredness was telling a story of when he was teaching in Jerusalem. And, of course, he had, you know, lots of very well-educated, knowledgeable Jewish people attending his classes. And one day he just thought, well, here, as I tell him about Joseph Smith, and I'll also tie in the Messiah ben Joseph traditions. And he just started teaching about Joseph Smith. And before he finished, before he got to it, he heard murmurs from the back row of people saying Messiah ben Joseph because they could see it. You know, the ones that knew about it could recognize the pattern there. And so this is something that's... some people might say that's altogether too convenient for Joseph Smith to have this in there, but it is an ancient tradition, so we also have that.
And most of those traditions weren't actually available in Joseph Smith's day. So
yeah.
A lot of the Jewish material just wasn't accessible outside of the Hebrew Bible.
Well, there are things like that all the time. I think of the book of Moses in particular. I was reading the article by Doug Clark in BYU Studies from several years ago about Moses chapter 1. You know, Moses is taken up on the high mountain. And I think it's important to remember that the book of Moses was written, translated, inspired, almost at the same time the Book of Mormon was. I mean, Joseph had the Book of Mormon at press, and then this comes forward. Very, very contemporaneous.
Yeah, December 1830.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just a few years or a few months after the organization of the church.
Right, but the tradition that is described in the Pearl of Great Price has some parallels with the Book of Jubilees, which was unknown at Joseph's time.
Well, there's a reference to it in an Egyptian papyrus.
Which Joseph, of course, wouldn't have known.
Yeah, it was not fully published until about 100 years after Joseph Smith died.
Yeah.
And so a little bit late for that, but it's very interesting.
I personally refer to those kind of things as internal evidences. In other words, where the Book of Mormon and other translations from Joseph Smith have parallels to the ancient world, that he really couldn't have done it. And then you have the external evidences and things like that that a lot of people seem to get wrapped around the axle about. But I wanted to ask both of you about something. The title of this is, you know, They Lived After the Manner of Happiness. But then in the first section, they talk about the priority that's given to the individuals and families who are studying this section of the scriptures is about agency and its priority. And they refer to Elder Christofferson giving a talk an article in 2014. And in his teachings about agency, Lehi identifies essential conditions that make agency possible to enable us to reach our divine potential. So the first is a knowledge of good and evil. A second is a law given to mankind. Then you have opposing or enticing choices. And then you have the power to act. So we're given those things, and how do we? I guess it's a challenge that all of us we know it, we talk about it, but actually enduring agency can be a little difficult sometimes because people act in ways that are harmful to themselves and others all the time.
Yes, that's true. There are a lot of facets about agency that, because it's such a key feature in the church and a key teaching, but in the church, you need to remember that agency always comes with accountability. And so that when they used to recite the young women's value, is agency and accountability were one value. So we have the ability to act, and we also have bear the responsibility of the actions that we make. And I also should point out that if anybody, listener who has had some experience with Latin already knows this, but agency and act come from the same root in Latin. It's part of the same verb. So the verb is ago, the present participle is agens, where we get agency from, and agent. And then the past participle is past form is acti, actum, is where we get act from, and also nouns actor. So they're related. So when you're an agent, you're the lawyer here. You can correct me on the legal sense, but an agent acts on behalf of an entity. And so what it says in the Doctrine and Covenants is that we are agents unto ourselves. So we get to act for ourselves.
Yeah, I was thinking,
and we're also
Section 93.
We also can be, we can also be agents for the Lord and act for Him. And so we need to keep clear on when we're acting for the Lord and when we're acting for ourselves. But in either case, we are responsible for the actions that our activities and the actions that we do. So if we're acting for ourselves, we're responsible for our actions. If we're acting on behalf of the Lord, then He's not going to ratify it unless He agrees with what we've done. So we need to, and we need to be careful where we have even more accountability before God for those times when we're acting on His behalf. But those sorts of things figure into agency. And when Elder Packer pointed out that in the Doctrine and Covenants we have moral agency. We're not free agents. We are moral agents, and so we can act for good or for ill. And we are accountable for the good and the ill that we act. And if you look in 2 Nephi 2, that's also the way that it's laid out. I'm talking about acting and being acted upon. And I actually had an odd experience many years ago with my son, who was an infant. And at the point where where I actually got to observe him, recognize that he could act and not just be acted upon. He was sitting in, we had him in his car seat, and we had a little toy clipped to the top. and he was just waving his hands and knocked the toy, and it swung. And you saw a little light go on in his brain, and then he could start doing it deliberately. And so at that point, he was no longer just acted upon. He also realized he could act for himself, and that came at a very early age.
Mm-hmm. It's still going, I would imagine.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Kevin, you have a fascinating opportunity to deal with people who, in many ways, surrender their agency. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, this is addiction recovery. And it's interesting that the 12 steps of addiction recovery are in the Book of Mormon. And addiction recovery is about, you know, essentially about recovering your agency. Because it turns out addiction is a disease that affects choice. That it means that the cravings make it so that you tend to make poor decisions, not thinking of consequences. And recovery, a lot of it, and like doing the Searching Fearless Moral Inventory, it's looking over our whole lives and seeing and attaching actions and choices to consequences. To be able to see that, to write it down, to think about it. You know, and this is what happens to Alma when he remembers all of his sins. He's basically, the angel is taking Alma through the fourth step so that he's looking at his choices and the consequences and how it affected not only him, but other people and other people and other people. To be able to see every action within not just a personal impulse, but in time and space. And that's one of the things that helps people accept boundaries and accept conditions and accept responsibility. There's in the Nibley Fetch Drift, one of the essays in there was about Native American cultures and about how that they would teach responsibility by telling stories about Coyote. And Coyote is a sacred clown. He's the one that gets to act on all of his self-centered, egocentric impulses and desires. But in the stories, the consequences always come. So that there's a certain amount of, he's being bad. You know, it's like when we're kids watching Donald Duck, in a sense. You know, he's the one who is naughty and bad and a little bit exciting, but he always has to pay the price.
All right.
Part of the teaching is to attach those consequences to the price rather than just the impulse of the moment and to be able to see that. And so this big part of the process is being able to say, it's not all about me. It's never all about me. So freedom is not the first and great commandment. Love is, because love is saying we're all in this together. And that because that's always there, if I'm going to accept that I'm part of this society on this planet that has a history and a future, among other people, then my choices should take that into account. And I can only do that if I think about other people and if I think about consequences in every single choice I make.
And that helps deal with those. We've got a caller on the line. Good evening, caller. Welcome to Interpreter Radio.
Yes, am I up?
You're up.
Yeah, I wondered when I heard that dial tone if that was an attempt to put me on after the telephone rings had run out.
It's possible.
Well, any case, yes. And for that last, I would comment, the first commandment is actually caritas. It has a lot of ways of translation. Love is, I think, the LDS preference. There are others. But yes, yeah, caritas, Latin term. Well, I was actually
talking
about
Greek.
What?
It's not caritas in Greek. So
what is it in Greek?
Well, it depends on which passage you're referring to, or I would have to pull it up to make sure that I'm remembering it correctly. But
all last year, John brought his Greek New Testament.
Well, that's why I used the Latin term, because I think the Greek is a tad ambiguous, Latin is a translation of the Greek, but there you go. In any case, I was actually talking about agency. First of all, there's a little bit of a dichotomy between LDS and other people who call themselves Christian. The LDS refer to free agency. The others refer to free will, with slight nuances in meaning of that. And I'm glad that you brought up the Latin derivations of act and agency, because as I see it, agency means something that acts in an expected manner.
I don't know about that. I'm from a legal standpoint. You
well, like,
act within certain bounds. So, for
yeah,
example,
like for example
I'm an agent for my principal, and I have certain authorities granted by the principal. And if I act beyond those boundaries, my actions are void.
Yeah, like in chemistry, we have reagents. I'm not completely sure of the Latin meaning of the re prefix. However, those are chemicals that do something expected, usually, not always, you get surprises. See, where was I headed with this? Yeah, the agency. I'm not quite sure why the LDS insists so vehemently on using free agency. It sounds like they're talking about professional athletes in some league who get to have some say in which team they sign on to.
I think you're dealing with a common usage for people that they don't mean it in that way.
And they don't mean you get to choose which team you're going to shoot hoops for.
I think what they mean is for free agency, and it's just like John was saying at the beginning, the agency comes with accountability. It's not free. And, in fact, very often, and you read the statements of the general authorities of the church, especially now, they don't just say free agency. I mean, free agency, like you said, that's a term that doesn't have the same meaning and applicability that it does here. So, but people use that term all the time, but that doesn't mean it's an official doctrine of the church in that way.
Even if it's free will, I would expect some accountability would be involved.
Well, and certainly that's what the scripture, particularly in section 93, says, that everything, every intelligence is placed in a sphere in order to act on itself. Or, in other words, we can choose to do certain things. But that's not free necessarily. It's just that we are free to choose. There's a big difference. So even as an agent for my principal in a legal stance, I am free to act beyond my agency. But the consequence is that either I accept the liabilities of my going beyond my boundaries or my remit, or the consequence is that my actions or promises are void to the person to which they're extended.
Right.
So I don't let myself get wrapped around the axle, if you will, about the term free agency, because I think people talk about it and they don't think about it in the complete sense that you are by being very literal minded about that. I think the analogy for that would be on my mission when I talk to people about, oh, I believe in the Trinity, and yet they picture in their minds, as they say, God the Father and the Holy Ghost, they picture exactly what the real doctrine is of three distinct individual spiritual and physical beings, as opposed to the three in one or the triune God, depending on whether you're talking to a Protestant or a Catholic. Either way, doesn't matter. So
Trinity actually came from Hinduism.
Well, I just think that the whole point is that. So, anyway.
But I was saying about the agency versus will, I think it's pretty much an artificial distinction, just branding, as the marketing people put it, to show that we are different than those other Christians because we have free agency and they have free will.
No. We have, so for Latter-day Saints, agency is a scriptural term. And we have... And the term that, in its fullest thing, is not free agency. That's a misappropriation, but is moral agency. We have the ability to choose our actions. And
but we don't have free
morals. Then we have the concomitant responsibility that we will be held accountable before God for our action. And so that... Latter-day Saints base that on Scripture and on scriptural terms. Some Latter-day Saints have adopted manners of speaking that don't accord with Scriptures and can't be said to be scriptural or maybe doctrinal, and unfortunately, because language is as it is and is shared among all kinds of people as a means of communication, free agency has developed in the sporting world and to mean something other than what it may, what Latter-day Saints, who were using it before it was a sports term, were using it. And this is one of the problems that comes up, is that when you've got two different people using the same terms, two different groups of people using the same terms to mean different things, then there is often some confusion. And sorry that you...
Yeah, my point here is that we shouldn't try to draw a distinction when it doesn't really exist.
Well, but
try to come to terms.
Free will is not scriptural. The term does not show up in the scriptures.
Well, I don't really study it, but I'm just saying that it may be just a semantic point, but nevertheless it has similar meaning, and we should try to have as common terms as possible without actually causing confusion.
Well, in that case, we probably ought to stick to the scriptural term.
Yeah. Now, which scripture are you referring to? Is it in the Bible? Because other people don't necessarily accept the LDS scriptures as scripture. I mean, do you accept the Bhagavad Gita, or the Quran, or the Popol Vuh? Okay. Well, hey, thank you. You can continue commenting, but I got to go. Thanks. Bye.
Well, we'll thank that caller for coming on with us tonight. So, Kevin, where exactly does the agency fit into God's plan? And while you're thinking about that, I'll tell you about an experience that I had, and I think I've mentioned it before, but down in St. George, I was asked by our stake president to help people who were going through these faith crises. And I had a counseling experience that it was very emotionally distressing to me, not really related to that, but it happened about the same time, and it was affecting me, and my wife, Janae, suggested, you need to talk to the stake president, who's now a general authority, and I'm ask him to set me apart in this thing he'd asked me to do. And he said, well, Brother Hutchinson, it's not a handbook call, so I will give you a dispensation. Come by the office Tuesday, and we'll do that. So I did. He gave me a particular blessing, and one of the things I remember distinctly about it is that I would learn to appreciate and celebrate agency in the way that our Father in Heaven appreciates and celebrates the principle of agency. And I found that as we're going through this section, to have the principle of agency be the primary point from which our discussions for this section of the Scriptures should start is pretty interesting, and to celebrate it. But think about that. And we talked about the Book of Moses earlier. God weeps about how his children are exercising their agency. I mean, a third of the hosts don't even make it to the earth. And then we come to the earth, and lots of these bad things happen as a result of us exercising agency.
Well, that's 2 Nephi 2:16, wherefore the Lord God gave unto man that he should act for himself, wherefore man could not act for himself, save it should be that he was enticed by the one or the other. And so we're in the situation where we have choices, we're going to make bad choices, and that's why John was reading about the whole part of the thing, we can't get to the joy unless the Messiah cometh in the fullness of time, and that he may redeem men from the fall. And we become free forever, knowing good from evil, to act for ourselves and not be acted upon, save it be by the punishment of the law. At the great and last day,
We've got a phone problem here. We've got another call coming in, and trying to pick it up.
So, yes, I hopefully Kevin will be able to come back and finish his thought.
I think he's gone for the moment, but we'll
okay.
Get back.
I thought we'd shift gears while we have a little bit of time, okay. And we're still covering this.
We actually have another caller on the line, I think. Are you there, caller?
Yes. Thank you, brethren, for taking my call. And I think it's not a common phrase among us, thankfully, that I think out in the world, some people tend to say, well, the devil made me do it. I'm not responsible. The devil made me do it. And, you know, if we give up our agency to the devil, you know, then we're not accountable. You know, if the devil's making us do something, we're not accountable. But if the devil cannot force us to do something, then we're a free agent. We could choose. So when we choose evil, you know, we can't blame it on the devil. The devil can influence us for evil, or the Holy Ghost or God can influence us for righteousness or good. But
you bring up a good point. And I think that the devil made me do it is a phrase I haven't heard for many years. But an abdication of agency, or trying to shift the accountability for your actions onto another entity, is something that I've heard quite a bit. And
doesn't it start at the Garden of Eden?
Well, you still see it today. There are lots of attempts to shift the responsibility for our actions and our choices, and to try to absolve ourselves from accountability. It's a rhetorical trope that we throw in to say, well, I don't want to be held responsible for my actions, but we still are. And so sometimes the phrase these days is always born that way. And but you're right to bring up this trope that in all cases it's an attempt to keep our agency and try to deflect the responsibility for our actions.
Yeah. I see instances where somebody does something and then the defense is, oh, somebody knocked their hand off the iron rod. Or, you know, however that is. And certainly we are challenged and tempted by the adversary. There must needs be opposition in all things. However, we ultimately are responsible for those choices that we make and that those actions that we take. And if it's beyond our moral, it's beyond the commandments, then there's a price that has to be paid. And it is mitigated through the atonement, but that doesn't mean it's still not paid. And I think that's one of the main themes of this chapter. So thank you, caller. I appreciate you for bringing that up.
Yes, and just a couple quick more points. And that is, you know, when we raise children, you know, they're not accountable to 8 years old, and then they start becoming accountable for their action choices. And so when we raise children, we want them to grow in maturity. We want them to start taking responsibility for their lives, for their actions, and become an adult. And so, you know, people that never take responsibility, you know, remain children, or they don't take control of their lives. You know, we don't want to control other people, but we want to control our decisions, the decisions we make. And, darn it, there was one other point I wanted to make, but I lost it. I'm sorry.
Well, you'll be able to call another time. Thank you for your comments, caller. We appreciate it.
Okay.
So, John, before we started taking those calls, you wanted to get to another section.
Well, you know, it'd be a shame, since Kevin brought it up, if we didn't discuss something about the Psalm of Nephi. And that's in 2 Nephi chapter 4. What I wanted to point out is a little literary device that is in there that I haven't seen anyone comment on. And so if you remember, when the Book of Mormon is dictated, it's dictated all in one big, long stream, and there's no punctuation. That's all added by John Gilbert and other people later. So what they have instead is what I call verbal punctuation. So words that serve as punctuation markers. And one of them that shows up in an interesting way in the Psalm of Nephi is the term nevertheless. And the Book of Mormon uses this when it's going to bring an abrupt change in the direction of the discussion. And in this case, we have 2 Nephi 4, and it starts off in verse 16. Behold, my soul delighteth in the things of the Lord. And then it hits in 17, a nevertheless. And then, notwithstanding the great goodness of God, my heart exclaimeth, O wretched man that I am. So it's all positive, and then it's another nevertheless. And then it's all negative down through into verse 19. And it says, I desire to rejoice. My heart groaneth because of my sins. It's all negative. And then, nevertheless, I know in whom I have trusted. And the rest of the psalm is all positive. And those verbal punctuations mark turning points in the psalm's case of the whole mood of the psalm. And so there's just a small syntactic thing that's used rhetorically in this particular passage to mark signposts on the narrative mm-hmm. and structure it.
So, Kevin.
Yes.
You had brought up the Psalm of Nephi as well. What was that about that struck you in particular?
Well, this just where it's so personal and intimate. There's the sense sometimes when you're reading about Nephi's heroic actions that he's just always on the ball. You know, when he goes to, I know the Lord will give no commandment unto the children of man. You know, and he goes off and gets the plates in 1 Nephi 3:7. But you know, this you get to see his humanity there, and when he just says, I mean, I'm encompassed about because of the temptations and the sins which do so easily beset me. Yeah. And that's something that we can relate with. But again, that turning point that he reminds us that there's also these good, great and wonderful experiences that he's had, and he pulls them together. And verse 26, oh, then if I have seen so great things, if the Lord in his condescension unto the children of men hath visited men in so much mercy, why should my heart weep and my soul linger in the valley of sorrow and my flesh waste away and my strength slacken because of my afflictions? And so it's this, awake my soul, no longer droop in sin, rejoice on my heart and give place no more for the enemy of my soul. He goes on like that. It's just very powerful, and it's uplifting, and it's encouraging to people who've been in trouble and who have struggled, because he takes you through both sides of it, and he keeps pointing the way that there's discouragement, there's failure, there's disappointment, but yet there's also this beauty and this hope and this promise, and don't forget that. And take advantage of that and follow it. And take it as and reach out to God and get as high and as joyful as you can be. It's beautiful.
It's great. There's not much else to say it other than if even Nephi feels that way, I think a lot of the rest of us have need to feel that way too.
Yeah, and it's interesting on the balance of it. So the first positive part is short. The second part, which is negative, is a little bit longer. But the longest stretch is the positive part at the end. So the emphasis is on the uplifting part at the end.
And then the last... And
there have been, yeah.
Go ahead.
Sometimes I've assigned people, that have been working on recovery, just to read that one chapter and come back to me and talk about it. And sometimes I'll say, that's just what I needed.
Yeah. So we've got about 2 minutes before the break, gentlemen. And, the last part talks about living after the manner of happiness in chapter 5. I mean, they've broken away from the brothers. They've gone out and they build the temple and other things, and they're living after the manner of happiness. But next week, we'll be talking about, the following week, the reading is going to be 2 Nephi 6 through 10, which is an incredible
yes.
sermon on the atonement.
Yes.
So in about 30 seconds each, tell the listeners, if you would, some things that maybe they could be looking for as they're studying that section. So, John, you go first, and then Kevin, but we really have about 30 seconds.
Just read it. Don't skip it. Read it.
Read it together.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Kevin.
I think that the late, great Bill Hamlin gave, a presentation on the Maxwell Institute that you can find, that where he talks about it as a Day of Atonement ritual.
And
I
was thinking that, but I wasn't able to find it this afternoon. So is that a presentation at Maxwell Institute that he gave?
I know it.
It's no longer on their website, so I'd have to go.
Maybe Scholars Archive?
I'd have to hunt for it.
Yeah.
Not everything got transferred.
Well, it's worth hunting for because I've heard it, I've read it, and I've done a lot of research about the Day of Atonement and how it was similar to a Day of Atonement, what they call it, a sermon, admonition from the high priest?
I've forgotten the term.
Yeah, and I haven't been able to look it up myself either. So anyway, we want to thank all of you for joining us and the callers. Please stay tuned after the break. We're going to be talking about some issues involving the new First Vision podcast that the church has put out, as well as several offerings from an interpreter that hit the internet this week, and several other things as well. So join us. We'll be right back after this brief news break.
You're listening to Kate.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson, one of your co-hosts for the Interpreter Show tonight, which is Sunday night here, sponsored on K-Talk Radio, and then also sponsored, of course, by the Interpreter Foundation. We're just the radio branch. My co-hosts this evening are John Gee.
Hello.
And Kevin Christensen. Kevin?
Greetings.
And just want to get into this by thanking our sponsor once again, the Cruise Lady. And if you're interested in a Latter-day Saint cruise that can give you some kind of a tour or a lot of important information about gospel topics or Book of Mormon scholarship or something, cruiselady.com is the place to visit online. Now, you can also call them at 801-453-9444. So we mentioned earlier the next one up will be a Book of Mormon tour with Martin Tanner, who's one of our radio hosts, and he also is a KSL host. And that'll be in April of 2020, and you'll sail through the Panama Canal. You'll see Mexico, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Colombia, a lot of Book of Mormon evidences and current scholarship. Now, another one we mentioned with Dan Peterson in July, but the one next after the one in April is in June of 2020. And this is with Professor Jack Welch. And you can see where he discovered chiasmus in the Book of Mormon. You'll have the rare opportunity to see the world-famous Passion Play over Amergap, which has been every decade. And John is just laughing because I'm butchering. He says, no, I've got it right for a change. It only took me two years. In 1633, the residents of Ober-Ammergau vowed that if God spared them from the bubonic plague, every 10 years they would produce a play depicting the last days, resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, the visitors were spared from death, and they have faithfully produced that play every 10 years, and it'll be on again this summer, and you'll be able to go see Professor June of 2020. So if you'd like more information, go to cruiselady.com or call them at 801-453-9444. And we really want to thank Cruise Lady for sponsoring this program. It enables us to have a better continuity. That'll be up to your judgment whether that's effective as we think it is. But you can thank them by going to cruiselady.com or calling them at 801-453-9444. So I wanted to start, Kevin and John, by talking a little bit about the interpreter offerings this week, which it just seems that there's more and more all the time. For example, Friday, they released a review by Don Perry of a recent book about Isaiah. And he called his review An Approach to Isaiah Studies. And he kind of talked about The Vision of All by Joseph Spencer, which is published by Greg Coverd Book. But mainly, the whole thrust of the review was to talk about how often Jehovah and Jesus Christ are referred to in the book of Isaiah. And lest you think that Don Perry is just your typical quote-unquote apologist. Don Perry is a member of the International Dead Sea Scrolls team, and he has just released an incredibly scholarly book. It's about 500 pages, I understand.
It's about 2 inches thick. I've seen a copy.
From Brill.
It goes through every textual variant between the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text of the Book of Isaiah. And it's
highly technical.
It's extremely technical. So Don is a colleague of mine and a friend, and he's long worked on both the Dead Sea Scrolls. If you buy the reader's edition of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it has Don Perry as the editor. He's edited 3 or 4 different editions of the Dead Sea Scrolls in toto. And he's also done a number of books on Isaiah himself.
Yeah, and for the general reader, and many of them are from Deseret. I think of the big black. I think it's got a black cover.
There's also the visual. There's an Understanding Isaiah. There's a Visualizing Isaiah, which is a big picture book with all sorts of photographs that illustrate some of the phrases that are used in Isaiah. So he's got a substantive body of work to come and talk about Isaiah.
In this review encourages us to learn ancient Hebrew and makes a real strong argument that if you're going to instruct on the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, it really helps to at least make a stab at understanding ancient Hebrew.
And I think he also argues that at a certain point in the church, we have enough people who command Hebrew well that it's not really responsible to go proclaim yourself an expert on Isaiah and not be able to deal with it in the original language. And I think that's one of the points that he makes. It was interesting that there's one line in the book that he was reviewing that sort of triggered his thing. And the line, I'm quoting it from memory. I know you have it there in front of you, and it's the line the author of the book had said, "Stop looking for Jesus in Isaiah."
Yeah.
And
now, granted, I think that was a rhetorical device from the, as opposed to, but that triggered. And then also the one where, well, Jesus is in Isaiah, I think. And we talked about that, how Brother Spencer is trying to kind of have it both ways. He doesn't seem to want to land on one side or the other, but to make both camps happen.
Don's review is a passionate plea in some ways for learning Hebrew. It definitely changes the way that you look at things. One thing that people don't know or may not appreciate is that President Nelson has even tried his hand learning Hebrew and Greek, and he hasn't been noted in the past for his remarkable facility with languages.
Well, you
but
watch
he's
it.
Becoming a little
you,
more
you
known for that
yeah, I
now.
I was going to say, you watch him when he does these tours in South America, and he's able to give it to them in their own language. It's simple and straightforward, but it's very impressive. You know, the other things that the foundation has been putting out, the eighth final installment of Brant Gardner's new book called Labor Diligently to Write, Ancient Making of a Modern Scripture, was released. And then just yesterday, I mean, this is a great feature. So those of you who haven't done it, I encourage you to just subscribe to the Interpreter, to just get their notification. For example, the Interpreter Foundation blog just yesterday morning posted an interview with Royal Scout by Dan Peterson about the critical text project of the Book of Mormon. And I would point out that on Wednesday, January 15th, at BYU,
that's this coming Wednesday,
he's going to be presenting on the use of the King James Version language in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, this is the next fascicle in his study of the critical text of the Book of Mormon, and it will be at 7 o'clock in the Hinckley Alumni Center on the BYU campus, and it's co-sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation and BYU Studies. And so if you're in Provo, that's one worth going to. Royal Skousen is noted for a number of things. One is meticulous work in the critical text, and he's a world-renowned linguist, and he's also very plain-spoken.
Well, plain-spoken is being generous. I would bring a drink of water because you'll need it.
He will tell it as it is.
Yes.
And he will not, he's not going to bury any of his findings, no matter which way they fall. And he will tell it like it is, and he will have a good 300 pages or so to back up his opinion. If you want, if you go read through his volume,
eventually.
No, it's out.
That one is out. Okay.
He will give you the highlights on Wednesday, and it's will be worth.
A lot of his work, but the one I refer to most is the Yale edition of the earliest text of the Book of Mormon, which I understand he had the cooperation from the church in putting out. Seems like yesterday, but
I remember wondering about his particular modus operandi when it came out, and the wisdom of it has been made apparent since then. So it's a nice addition. It has a number of features that you won't find anywhere else. He is the first person after John Gilbert to go and repunctuate the entire Book of Mormon himself.
Mm-hmm. I've had him on my program in St. George, and talking about his project, which he's been working on for 3 years.
Close to I don't know how long officially he's been doing it since the late 80s.
Okay,
so.
So it's at least 30 plus.
Yeah, at least 30 plus. He's it's meticulous. There are very few stones that he doesn't leave unturned, and I'd be hard pressed to name any of them.
Yeah. So that's another one came out from Interpreter, and he occasionally puts articles that are available for us. They have the podcast from these radio programs. Another one is a reprint series from the Science of Mormonism series that they've been releasing. And then on top of that, they've got three podcasts. One of them is the part one of a podcast they did with Brad Kramer, who's written two books on the Book of Mormon, both published by Greg Coford Books. The first one is about a rabbinical method of studying the Book of Mormon. I think the title is Beholding the Tree of Life or something like that. And then Brad has another one for the second part, which is about how the Book of Mormon combats anti-Semitism in the Book of Mormon in the New Testament. And so Brad talks about both these. And this is a fascinating project that he undertook. He has joined a rabbinical biblical studies class where he lives in North Carolina. And so he talks about that experience and how he those techniques to the Book of Mormon. It's a fascinating book. And then another podcast that they've done, which will lead into the next section that we're going to talk about today, is Teachings and Testimony of the First Vision, some doctrinal teachings about the First Vision. And there are three parts to this. It's put out by Dennis Horn, and this is just another addition, if you will, of Interpreter to all of the projects that we've described. All of this, I would point out, is free to the general public. free, period. And it's incredible how much the Interpreter Foundation is able to do. And while this is a fundraiser, if you are looking for a place to make a donation, it is a 501c3 corporation. So your donations to Interpreter Foundation are tax deductible. And we've been talking now for almost 20 minutes just about
what's come out in the last
this week.
And one of the other things, if you're feeling a little overwhelmed, if you go into the journal and an Interpreter, they have a number of different indices. So if you're interested in a particular topic, you can find out what's been published through the indices, and that can help you at least find what you're most interested in right now. And
yeah,
then,
and going back through the history of Interpreter.
Right. So it has everything. It's all indexed. Mm-hmm. And so it's covered. So if you're interested in that, if you're feeling overwhelmed, go to the index first and look at what you're interested in.
Yeah. So before we came, I was helping my mom, who's 85, download the podcast app on her phone so that she could access the new podcast released by the church on the first vision. There are six of them plus a prologue. And I think the prologue is mostly repeated in the first podcast, but it's only two. And these are extremely well-done podcasts that want to portray the first vision for the listeners in ways as it is viewed by scholars and historians who have made studying this period of time, this context, this environment, if you will, their lives, to help us get a new picture in our minds about the first vision. So we've all had varying levels of experience with these podcasts. And Kevin, I think you've been through the manuscripts or transcripts of all of them, right?
Yeah, I read through the transcripts today. So I tend to read faster than I listen, but I found them all very fascinating. Just written at a high level of scholarship and some interesting insights and just the breadth and depth in each case, but also very accessible.
Well, and I can tell you from listening to them, I've listened as I've gone back and forth from St. George a couple of times down in tomorrow morning. But it's a well-done presentation of the narrator talking about where we intend to go, introducing the scholars or the commentators, and then a little bit of music in the background to help listener kind of slow down and think through what he's heard. The episodes are not all the same, and I'm not a podcast person. I really prefer to read. I've got a friend of mine who only listens to podcasts, which I think is part of his problem, but that's another story. You're not always able to get the full citations, or can't stop and check something like you would really like to when you're having this presentation. And because it's verbal and because there's a performance element to it, I find that it's a little easier to get the listener to go in the direction you want him to go. But having said that, more and more frequently, the methods of communication we're using these days are audio. For example, audiobooks constituted, and this is something I do on my program in St. George, 30% of all book sales last year were audio. That's a huge increase. The effort of digital rather than CD, so I've got all of these, you know, classic books, long books on CD, lots and lots of CDs, take up a lot of storage space. Now it comes right through your device, computer, laptop, iPad, you know, phone, right in, and it's a way of communicating, and I think that's why we all of a sudden have the church doing podcasts. They're doing a Saints broadcast, which I didn't really pay much attention to until this one.
Well, the church is, in some ways, has been doing this for a long time. If you've had the Gospel Library app and you've got the scriptures on there,
yeah,
there is actually a little button off to the side that you can push on,
oh, yeah,
and have it read to you.
Yeah.
And they've been, if you look back at this sort of audio book from the church, it goes back to the 70s. So that's, yeah, more than 40 years that they've been
For a long time, the primary narrator was
Lindsay Kennard.
Well, no, oh, Lindsay from KSL.
Oh, Bruce Lindsay.
Bruce Lindsay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So there are a number of uses that they've made of this. This is the first time they've more or less done it with an issue that I'm aware of, and I hadn't heard of these until yesterday. I'm sure they had to have been out there a little bit before then.
Well, no, they. I actually got the email from the Joseph Smith Papers, which is another email I subscribed to just last week, and they said this will be coming. And I thought it was supposed to come out on the 7th. I saw it on the 6th and immediately shared it with, you know, my kids, who probably knew about it. I did.
Well, there are advantages and disadvantages to each of the different formats. And so one way of looking at it is this is a way of getting, when they talk about the gospel going out to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, and trying to approach people where they're at, this is an effort to do that. And in another way, it's providing it in as many formats as possible and providing, trying to get the information out. And there's, of course, been renewed emphasis on this since President Nelson encouraged everybody to study the restoration of the gospel. And you can't really do that without talking about the first vision, because that's so key to that's what starts everything off. Yeah.
But the podcast specifically talks about it was a while before it was referred to as the first vision.
Yeah.
So Kevin, as you were going through these, what struck you most about these six podcasts?
Well, that they're very well informed, and that each one they bring a breadth of contextual knowledge. They don't necessarily dump everything that they know, but you get the sense that the people doing, you know, the talking, you know, they have, each of the podcasts will have two or three different scholars, like Stephen Harper, who's just written a book on the first vision that's come out, Rachel Cope, Christopher Jones, Brent Rogers. Each of these different scholars will, you know, you get the sense that they've read lots of diaries. They've you know, immersed themselves into the intellectual environments and the physical environment. When they're talking about, you know, the grove, what's the place like? And they'll talk about the different kinds of trees that were growing there, and that some of them grew 100 feet tall, and what it was like, and what it was, you know, why Joseph Smith would have gone to that particular grove, and, you know, to find the solitude for this experience, and then how people thought about it after. It you get a sense that the topic and the people, that they take it very seriously, and they're treating it as something that is holy and deserves respect and deserves as much immersion as you can. You know, I live in you know, near Pittsburgh, so it's you know, a 5 or 6 hour drive, and I can be up and you know, walk on Cumorah and go to the Smith home and walk in the Sacred Grove. And I, you know, I've done it a couple of times, and it is something that adds to my appreciation of the gospel, you know, in the sense that it becomes real and concrete in a way that just reading a testimony, you know, is helpful. But then this, I get this added dimension to it, and, you know, a sense that, you know, we're coming up on 200 years since it's happened. That's not really all that long ago.
No,
we got
Bushman's book, Rough Stone Rolling, in time for the bicentennial, yeah, of Joseph's birth. And really, that was a great effort to correct the historical record, if you will. Say what you want about the overall book itself. There's pros and cons to it, I know, but it began a process that we will continue to go through, and President Nelson's admonition to talk about the first vision is something that for each of us to individually study it is something this podcast is specifically enabling us to do, because the vast majority of us will never get to Palmyra. I've been there twice, and it's been a marvelous spiritual experience for me each time. Each one was different, and it's certainly nothing like, of course, it was for Joseph. And yet the whole purpose of this is to try and set the context, particularly in the middle podcasts, where you try and put yourself to experience what he experienced. One that struck me in particular was when they talked to Mark Staker about what did the Grove look like. Everybody sees it. I mean, it's got 100,000 plus visitors a year, and it's almost always in the summer when it's green. Well, what did it look like early in the spring of 1820 when it was not? I mean, it looked way different than it does now. He talks about the trees, how tall they were, what they looked like, and that they were very likely not green leaves, but that they were flowers. That the trees that were there were flowers of varying colors, and you can imagine how beautiful that would have been while Joseph was there. And then when you think about flowers, all of a sudden your brain brings to mind the fresh air, the scent, what that really would have been like for him, at least to start. At least for me, it started me thinking about that process and picturing it in a way that I had not really come to mind before. Because we've seen thousands, if seems like, of paintings where it's all green and lush, and you know, in fact, it's really interesting. There is a book put out by a Born Again Press that has a picture of the first vision and the Sacred Grove done by Greg Olson in it, not identifying the young man on his knees in that forest as Joseph Smith. I love that. But anyway, that's a side note. I hope I don't get
into
trouble.
I wonder if Greg Olson got any royalties on that.
I'm sure he does.
Well, you never know. We picture the things happening, and there's a special area marked off for visitors now to go, and it's kept as a forest to remind, to bring that to mind. But we don't even know if that's the right direction.
Oh, yeah.
The
podcast makes it plain. We don't know exactly where it was. Was it part of the farm? Was it near the farm? Was it somewhere away? I mean, they make it, they are very admitting that they don't know exactly what the site was. But once again, the whole purpose of it is not to, I think it makes it clear in the first podcast that the purpose isn't to get all of your historical data in line as to dates and places and so forth, but to set the atmosphere, if you will, and help bring out the feelings and emotions or the experience that Joseph had in a physical sense as opposed to the data.
Although Joseph, to be fair, when in the recountings, the official recountings, Joseph Smith actually does a good job describing his experience, both what he can say and what he can't say. And what the important points that he thought that members of the church ought to take away from his experience. And give him credit, because I took a class from Arthur Henry King, who is a British stylistician. And it was the Joseph Smith story that brought him into the church because he'd spent decades refining his skills to tell when people were trying to persuade him, trying to pull the wool over his eyes, right? And he says there's none of that in the Joseph Smith story. He says he's just... And at the end of it, Professor King had an amazing control of the English language, and he said of it, "I'm not a good enough person to write that well." It's a masterpiece in its own right from a literary perspective, but even more so because it's not meant to be literature. It's meant to tell you what happened.
Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, they talk about the different versions of the first vision that have been given by Joseph Smith over the years, something that's been openly available for a long time. And one of the things that they said struck people who read the earlier versions that aren't as highly publicized was how personal they were, and that it was really Joseph's personal search for salvation. And the point that John just made about there's more to this that Joseph told us about it, what he put, was really pertinent. That's something that Don Bradley said to you and I when we were here a month ago talking with him about his book, was that Joseph, obviously there was more to the experience than that. But what strikes you about those early ones, those early reports?
Well, the 1832 one, when I first heard that, shortly after I got back from my mission, I'd run across the article in the 1970 Ensign that mentioned the accounts, and I went and tracked down Bachman's book, and I had all of the accounts in it, and they'd also been published in BYU Studies, and I got those too. And just to read through them, especially the kind that has the transcript, you know, it includes, you know, photograph the actual pages, you know, along with the print, because that tells you some other things. But there's this sense that there's this, it's written, you know, in a breathless, it's just one big long sentence, basically. But it's the utter sincerity and the trying to capture something important and sacred, and it comes through. But also you're struggling with the medium. You know, I'm a professional writer. You know, I'm a technical writer, and I've also written, you know, I guess about 3 dozen articles have been published, and I've done fiction and been through school and written all sorts of papers. And writing can be a struggle. And it takes a while to master it, and so when I read the different accounts, I see the growth of Joseph Smith as a person. So for me, in going back to the first account, you know, aside from just reading it and feeling just this breathless excitement, you know, to say this happened to me, in the terms he does, one of the things that struck me was Matthew Brown's book, A Pillar of Light, that came out, you know, maybe a decade ago. And it's one of my favorite ones on it, because he points out that it's full of allusions to particular scriptures. I mean, those scriptures, you know, especially where, you know, in the 1838 account where he says, I often, you know, compared myself to Paul. And what Matthew Brown does is he shows, yes, that's exactly what he's doing in the earliest account of the vision. He's identifying so strongly with Paul that he uses some of that language to try and, you know, make the connection explicit, and that he's focusing on, you know, the forgiveness and his encounter with Christ, and he alludes to certain psalms that talk about seeing God face to face. So that even though he's very young at this, he's, you know, in 1830, he's still 1832. He's still quite young, and he hasn't been to college, but he's been studying the scriptures. You know, this is when they've been working on the inspired translation, the inspired revision of the Bible. So, you know, it's close study for over a year with Sidney Rigdon, and there is some of that emerging artfulness that comes through, but it's not pretentious. It's just part of just how he expresses himself. It's part of his sincerity, and it really works for me.
Well,
getting
to John's point and the point you made, the podcast was pointing out, and I was listening to it again today, it talks about a place in the manuscript that Joseph Smith writes the word, I saw a pillar of fire. And then he stops. And it's clear because there's a different ink that he comes back to it after that, crosses out the word fire, and writes pillar of light instead of pillar of fire.
Yeah.
So obviously throughout this process, and in fact probably throughout his life, he was replaying the vision in his mind and gaining greater understanding of what actually he saw.
Well, and even that sort of detail, one of the early accounts says, or one of the accounts says that he thought the trees were on fire. And so but how to describe what it is that he experienced, you'd be struggling with
terms. You've got Moses and the burning bush.
Right.
Moses. That is burning, but not consumed.
Right. And so I think of the various details, the one that strikes me the most these days is in the David Nye report in 1843, where Joseph is bothered by what's going on, by the religious ferment at the time. And he said, while thinking on this matter, I opened the New Testament promiscuously on these words in James. So, you know, when we think about him reading the Bible and studying the Bible, and his mother said, of all her kids, he was the least likely to go reading. And so this seems a little more in character with that he just basically opens the Bible at random and hits this passage.
His use of the word promiscuous.
Right. He flips it open. He's not starting with Genesis and is almost all the way done. He's not reading it all. He just flips it open, hits this, and says, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But then later as an adult, he realizes how impactful that particular scripture was in causing that action. Never did any passage of scripture come with more power to the heart of man than this did at this time tomorrow.
It's an important.
It entered with great force into every feeling of my heart. I reflected upon it again and again. He really has that moment in his memory, as a crucial moment. So he has not only the verse that he remembers, but his profound reaction to the verse. And I have some moments like that in my life. You know, some things that I read that just, you know, really bells started to ring, and I remember, sometimes I can remember where I was when I read it.
James must have been particularly pleased with that, because if you look at that passage in the context of James, so here James is writing to the church. They've all been scattered by Paul before his conversion, and they're all driven away from Jerusalem. They've been instructed by the apostles, and now they no longer have the apostles. And so the first thing that he tells them is, look, first things, if you don't know what to do, ask God. And so in the context when James is writing that, is exactly the sort of context that Joseph found himself in.
Well, and if he wasn't inclined to read a lot, he would have, like you said, just flipped it open. There it was. It seemed to apply to him. So he shut it, and he probably didn't pick up the Bible again, but it marinated in his mind as he thought it over.
Yeah, and he has to have been led to that. Because you think you've got a Bible of how many hundred pages in front of you, and you happen to hit on probably the best scripture.
Well,
that was actually originally written to apply to his situation.
There are times when that happens. You go to the temple, you seek an answer, open the scripture, and it's right there. That happened to my real important family. And I wouldn't recommend that for every question that you take to the Lord, but it does happen. And in fact, for some people, it's a gift. It's almost a gift. It happens often.
Yes, it did happen. It was precisely what he needed to to know, and that is right there. Yeah. And
so, Kevin, you were mentioning that Steve Harper has a new book out, and I think John's just got that book, and I've started it from Oxford, and can't remember the name of it, but it's far different than his 2012 book about the first vision, but primarily this one, the thrust of this one is about the issue of memory and how what we know about memory, both individual memory and cultural memory, or the memory of a community, affects our view of what really happened. And some of that comes into play in these podcasts where they interview Steve and he talks about, and I've never met him, so I can't say
he's a good
Steve.
Guy.
Okay, we'll just take your word for it, John. But he talks about, and he kind of simplifies his theory for the listener in the podcast. And frankly, for me, that pretty much covers the subject, because I always get a little concerned when you're dealing with important events like the First Vision, like the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, and you have limitations placed on you by your publisher. Because I interviewed Terrell Givens about By the Hand of Mormon and some of the other books he'd written for Oxford, and he particularly said that while Oxford is the premier religious publisher in the world, or one of them anyway, that they are very oriented away from devotional and inspirational. Like, we don't want to talk about the historicity of the First Vision or the Book of Mormon. We want to talk about facts and circumstances. We can talk about context. We can talk about a lot of other things. We can talk about psychological theories of memory or scientific issues of the brain and how we imprint these in our mind and all these things. But whether or not the First Vision actually happened, whether or not the three witnesses saw the angel, we're not going to go there.
You'd never know that Oxford was originally founded as a religious institution.
Well, so was Harvard. So was Yale. I mean, we can go there,
yeah,
too. So our universities have crept far away from that. But I have to tell you that in the broader scheme, John, as a book reviewer, I celebrated my 25th anniversary on the air in St. George last month. But I appreciate having a religious publisher who does put some kind of limitations on that, because there are other venues for devotional literature or something that wants to argue. Because I know, as you do, that Steve Harper believes that the First Vision actually happened.
Right. Well, Steve's got a range that he can do. So he can do the Oxford book. He was also supervisor on the Early Saints volume.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a range of material that he can deal with and deal with apparently quite well.
There's audience and there's tone and there's intimacy. I've had experiences where four different people basically told me for them their most profound spiritual experiences that they've had. One was my wife, one was my sister, one was a missionary companion, and one was my friend from high school. And they all told me these stories, and none of them knew each other. They all told me the same story. Using somewhat different language, but it was, an all this kind of, profound spiritual experience. And in each case, they'd all, climb to the top of the hill. To get there, a mountain, or a couple of them were on the same peak in Utah. They've literally gone up to the top of the same peak. And so people have these kind of experiences. And I think Richard Bushman wrote a really good article called First Visions, where he talked about, other people having these kind of convergent theophanies. And so I think it's important in understanding the first vision and that's something that the Book of Mormon points out, that God speaks to all people in all sorts of different ways.
Yeah.
And the first vision is a profound experience, but then the thing that really sets Joseph Smith apart is when Moroni comes. And then that adds on to everything else. That's, you know, and when we had Don Bradley, back a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about, not only does Moroni come, after the 4 years, but each of the days in the Jewish holidays turns out to be very significant. And the one, when he comes and gets the Book of Mormon is the first day of the Feast of the Trumpets, which is the trumpets blow to signify the gathering of Israel. So there's these huge things going on underneath the surface. But if we get our eyes open to it, then, like Alma says, our souls enlarge and our minds expand and it tastes delicious. We want to know more.
Yeah, I think...
And share it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's impressive about Joseph Smith's first vision and the various recountings of it is that there are repeated themes that are in all of them, things that he thinks are particularly important, and he never fails to hit those points because those are ones that he thinks are important to make, no matter what audience he's directing it to.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there's this consistency in it, even if he's telling it a little bit differently each time and may include certain details in one and not in another, the basic story doesn't change.
Well,
one of the things that strikes me about the first vision in particular is something that I come back to in my mind all the time, and that is the international growth of the church. I mean, the context for Joseph's first vision was the Second Great Awakening. The revival's going on. The podcast points out that there were specifically missionaries being sent from Upper New England into Western New York to make sure that all the people who left there and who left their families and went west looking for a new life were able to get the gospel to be established in their lives, so to speak. They were worried about. And a few years ago, I came across a book, and I've had this woman on my program in St. George. It's called A Global Testimony, and I think it's self-published, but it's compiled and edited by Katarina Jambrizek. And it's hard to find. It's a paperback. You can get it at Benchmark Books, or you can get it online from Amazon, but you can also get a Kindle or an electronic version. I can't recommend this book highly enough because it is the conversion stories of people from 60 different countries around the world. And yet they come to this story of Joseph Smith and the first vision. And in fact, when you look for that, let me just give you a couple of examples. From Romania, convert from Romania. For me, the first vision was real. The Book of Mormon was indeed the sacred word of God for the last days. Belgium, Joseph's prayer led to the first vision. On the strength of that, he taught his followers they were not required to believe blindly what was being taught. Finland, I believed Joseph Smith's story in the first vision because I, too, had a special spiritual experience when I was 10. I knew God could talk to us. The United Kingdom, they told me about the first vision. I was filled with mixed emotions. I wasn't close to believing a 14-year-old boy would have such a vision, but I eventually came to that reality. Russia, as I was listening to the first vision account described by Elder Noznikov, I looked into his eyes and felt that he was speaking the truth. Malaysia. I was 14. Because Joseph Smith had his first vision at that age, I felt a special connection to him as I reflected on the feelings that overcame me when I heard about it. Bolivia. They fully explained the first vision of Joseph Smith, and during the account of the first vision, the spirit was so strong, I felt that it was true. This was the most profound message I had ever heard or felt. The Marshall Islands. It just goes on and on and on. And it is amazing to me that people from different backgrounds, different economic strata, different cultures, you name it, rich, poor, male, female, teenagers, older people, married, single, whatever their circumstance, they hear the story of the first vision and they are confirmed in their belief by the Spirit. And it is international and universal.
And if you think about it, what Joseph Smith is doing in the first vision, without knowing it at this point, is doing precisely what Moroni urges the readers of the Book of Mormon to do, to find out for themselves, and following the exact process that he outlines, that he outlines in the Book of Mormon, and which he's given almost a dozen examples of through the text. So, yes, it is universal, and it's something that that can apply to every person and that everyone can know for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, in your experience out there, there's probably a higher percentage of first-generation converts. Do they talk about the first vision? Does that impact them in that way?
Well, some people do. It's whether the first vision of the Book of Mormon or Testimony of Christ. It's where they've come to a testimony of Christ and then they've wanted more from that, and then they may bounce from church to church, and then when they hear this story and hear about Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon, then they come and hear, this is more. And they're grateful for what they've had that led them here. But they're finding here there's more that they want and cherish. It's one of the lower per capita areas of the United States for LDS, but when I listen to the story each Sunday, it's fascinating, the range and the kind, and yet kinship and community that we all feel when we share our testimonies with each other. But we're a covenant community, and we're here to covenant with Christ, and are grateful for this ongoing light and revelation that is the restoration.
Now, one of the things that's also interesting with the first vision, and this comes out of my reading where I had been reading something, a communist talking about ancient Assyria. But one of the things that he points out is, in order to have the mandate of God, you have to have communication from God to the individual in order to actually have a mandate and be able to follow it. And to have a completely secular scholar recognize that basic thing, which starts off with the first vision and continues to the present in Revelation in the church, is a almost surreal experience. You wouldn't have expected to find that, but that's the importance of the first vision, is it opens the floodgates and shows that you, in order to follow the will of God and to know it, you have to know it. And in order to know it, you have to get it from the source. And if you don't have that, then you're missing something.
Well, the first vision, and the podcast makes this pretty plain, was not the first vision for a while. But after having many other experiences, such as Moroni, such as Peter, James, and John, such as John the Baptist, and others that Jack Welch talks about a little bit in some of his accounts in opening the heavens. I think there's a list of all the various appearances that manifested to Joseph.
Right, and there's also it's a great book and also has all of the accounts of both the primary ones where Joseph Smith is writing it down and the secondary ones where people are talking about what Joseph Smith.
Yeah, I remember years ago I ran across an article where they talked about how the first vision came to be a part of the proselyting presentations of the church, but it didn't start out that way. Well, it started with
I got that journal right here. It's it's in the Journal of Mormon History, actually, in 1980. that talked about that. Yeah, that's.
I came across a little after in 1980. I was in Canada. I didn't have access.
And, well, it's something that Nibley talked about in the 60s, but I think that's a problem with our, because we don't have almost any records of what Joseph Smith was teaching until Nauvoo.
Mm-hmm.
And, but occasionally you get these references. And
well, you have the story of him talking to the Reverend Matthias.
Yeah,
that guy's nicknamed Joseph Sykes.
Well, Josiah Sedges is another one, but you have there are some of these.
There are some of them.
There's
the
some accounts,
letter.
But the Wentworth letter is Nauvoo. So it's you start getting a feel for what Joseph Smith was actually teaching in Nauvoo, and we don't because our sources don't tell us how much he was talking about it before then or what. In many cases, what he was talking about.
Well, it was a gradual change in the record keeping of the church.
Yeah, and because of that change in the record keeping, we don't have records of it. But that's because we don't have records of almost everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it wasn't.
There's a really good
article
called. There's an article called "The First Vision and the Formative Years of the Church" that Tim Barker put on his blog in 2011, that's really worth reading because he, you know, aside from the main accounts, he just goes and talks about reminiscent accounts where people talk about where they just mentioned sometimes offhand that they heard Joseph Smith talking about this, and some of these predate the 1832 account. Or, you know, at least they point back to before the 1832 account, and there are also a couple of peaks in some of the newspaper accounts and things that there are people that knew what was going on.
And,
okay.
And we forget
to some degree.
Oh, well, we're out of time.
We're out of time. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us. I would encourage those of you who are interested, go to the podcast app and look for the First Vision podcasts by the Joseph Smith Papers Project. They are well worth your effort and time. Thanks for being with us. Good night.
Good night.